Hello and welcome to the next episode of the podcast on negotiation. And today with me is Dr. Rajiv Basamwait. Rajiv, great to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite.
Guys, you wouldn't believe, but Rajiv and I have met many years ago during a negotiation competition that we still organize. I thought it was, how long ago was it, Rajiv? 14 years? Like
14 years, yes.
14 years ago, can you imagine? And it's an absolute pleasure to and delight to introduce someone who is an innovator, who is active in the innovation networks, who is also himself an entrepreneur, very successful entrepreneur based in Aarhus in Denmark. Rajiv, what else is important about your background?
Well, yeah, I come with a slightly mixed background. I have a PhD in biophysics and a business degree in sustainability. So it's kind of I'm both a science and a business guy. In that sense. And then I teach innovation and entrepreneurship, but I'm also a practicing entrepreneur and I do game design on the side. So that probably sums up a little bit.
Wow, what an amazing profile. So I would even not dare to call it schizophrenic pracademic. I think there is also an additional aspect to it, and that's the aspect I would like us to focus on today. And because you are a creator and designer of games, tell us more about it, Rajiv, please.
Yeah, so I think from already when I was doing my MBA after my PhD, I was doing my MBA at the business school, and I started using games as a way to solve problems and just using games as a tool. And I noticed a lot of potential. I mean, apart from the fact that I won a lot of awards for a lot of the competitions, student competitions at that time that I took part in, games had a very strong impact on me, and I could see its impact on the world around me. And I just started sort of diving into it and using more and more of games. We already had a consulting studio on the side since 2010, but then at about 2014, we started sort of really using games as a strong tool. And I think in 2016 was when we came up with our first board game. And then since then, we've just been developing more. And today's game that we're going to be talking about is our sixth game. So it's been, so we've started to develop a catalog of games. But it takes time, each game, to develop, which is why, I mean, it's not that we're not churning out stuff. We are really thoughtfully trying to create something that makes impact and answers some critical questions.
And one of those areas where we need answers and solutions is definitely sustainability, regardless of what some powerful politicians might claim. I think we are approaching a point of irreversibility, and it's still in our hands to change the course of our future, and that's probably the reason why you decided to design and produce Pactopolis, right?
Yes. So it's interesting you asked that, because when we first started working on this, I mean, so I think it's important maybe for our listeners to just hear a little bit of context. So because I normally do entrepreneurship and innovation teaching, in which negotiations, of course, are an important part, and we want to train negotiations. My own background, like I said earlier, I have a PhD in the sciences, I have a business degree, but the business degree specifically was on sustainability. So it was an MBA in sustainability. So I was already quite into sustainability already. And when we were doing the negotiations, a lot of my science students, maybe some of them had a more environmental background, and those issues would start cropping up. And that's when we thought, okay, it's going to be important to be able to couple these together. So, but the start was to essentially design a negotiations game for training negotiation skills. That was the focus, because negotiation skills, especially for, let's say, STEM students, is generally a much harder task than it is for, let's say, business students. And I've always had the pleasure of having Chavi Chen from ISEC Business School, who probably you know very well, as a guest visiting professor to talk about negotiations in my classes. And I've on the other hand, I've gone and talked about entrepreneurship in her classes. And that's how we had this collaboration sort of ongoing. But when she used to come with these negotiation examples, I always wanted her to sort of, tailor it a little bit for the sciences. And usually it would be a climate-related topic or a water-related topic that would start coming up. So there was that kind of touch already there. And that's how I would say the idea of Pactopolis started, was to create a negotiations game. And sustainability just went, it was in the background. And then I think as we were developing it more and more, and I'll get to that in a bit, but what we did was we decided to bring it to the foreground. So it's not just in the background, it's not just a theme, but actually becomes much more important. And that way we balance both teaching negotiation skills, but also sustainability thinking at the same time.
So for our audience, I must admit that during a conference in Paris last week, I had a chance to receive a private demo. Thank you, Tara, for taking your time to do so. She's probably right now in the audience. I was deeply impressed with the fact that you decided to design, to go against the flow, right? Normally we, let's say, especially at business schools and engineering would probably, I would expect even more, put your ideas in the form, or to design your idea, to design this game as an online game. Yes, and instead you decided for a board game. Could you tell us a little bit more about the dynamics of the game, so that our audience can understand how the objective that you've just sketched briefly, combining negotiation with sustainability in a fun and an engaging way, how this turned into the dynamics of the game. So what do players do when they play Pactopolis?
Yeah, so I think maybe before I take people through the game idea or the gameplay, it's probably interesting for them to hear what have we done with the game in the sense that how was it integrated into the classroom? So as I told you before, the idea was always to have negotiations and sustainability come along. Then you ask the question, well, why a board game? We have been doing board games for a while now, so since 2014. And it's interesting that you say that we could have gone digital, but this is a very intentional decision that we are not growing digital. And it's not that we can't. We do have a digital game as well that we have done, but it's more about, I think there is something to in-person interaction that's much more powerful. And I see that, and usually when I think, I'm asked this question a lot at a lot of conferences and a lot of, like for all our games, not only this one, but why don't we do digital, or why don't we create a digital version? And my usual answer to that person is, why are you asking this to me in person at a conference?
Not per email.
Yeah, not per email, right? I mean, we could do a lot more digital discussions. We have the technology, but we still want to meet people. That's why we travel to conferences. And because there is something that happens in person, it's the same sort of feeling we had. And our philosophy with our games has always been, we want to enhance this kind of not only tactile learning, but also in-person interaction that I think is becoming weaker and weaker with the rise of digital interfaces. Now, again, we are not anti-digital. I'm very pro-digital. We are using a digital interface right now. And I think there is room and space for digital interfaces, but the focus is so much on digital innovations in the classroom that the focus on in-person interactions or innovating in those areas has been a bit, let's say, low. So we were like, okay, let's focus on that area. And funnily enough, it seems that we have established a niche because we do tend to stand out in areas where everybody comes with digital offerings and we come with old school tabletop offerings, but they're actually very engaging, and that's the reason why it's essentially a board game. But there's something else here. When you especially add complexity to the mix, and we always try and take complex topics, and sustainability, as we all know, is a complex topic. Negotiations is also a complex topic, and many of these that we have chosen, using a board game, I think allows us to scale complexity in a much easier way. And allows us to layer that complexity in a way that players can sort of digest it easier and better in this kind of in-person format. So that's been really why we went with that. So, and then of course, what happens with the game is we, of course, ensure that everybody gets a good start and fast start to the game. So this has been one of our focuses. One of our biggest focuses is how to get players very fast onto the game. So you don't spend a lot of time either preparing or reading, because these are barriers. And again, going back to old school board games, I don't know, have you played some board games, Remy, recently, or like, do you still play?
Oh yes, absolutely, many. One of my favorite games is indeed the Settlers of Catan.
Settlers of Catan, yeah. So there are some lovely games out there, but there's always been a barrier of games, and that's usually been the instruction manual.
Yes.
Right.
So, sometimes they are super big, and that discourages. Super thick, and that discourages people, you know, from getting engaged with the actual purpose of the game.
Yes. And that was one of our focus, that if we want to get a broader interest, and so that this game is not just for some people who only like games, or it's only for gamers, we really make sure that our games are actually designed for non-gamers, even though we're gamers ourselves. And when we do that, we ensure that the instructions are super light, super fast, and that you can get into and then get the instructions as you play along, or add the complexity as we go along. So that's been our, let's say, modus operandi here. And what we have done is, by doing this, we have actually seen that even people who normally say we don't play games actually engage and are actually doing, a very good job out of it, I would say. So with Pactopolis, what you do is you get handed a very simple instruction sheet, which is just 4 pages on a half A4, I would say, so an A5 size, with just 4 pages of instructions, which are just your instructions that only matters to you as the player. And that's because this is a game where we start with asymmetric information, in the sense that every player, which is represented by 4 different sectors, so we have 4 sectors in the game, as of now. I mean, we could always change the sectors, but right now the sectors we have gone for, or we have intentionally chosen, are energy. Specifically, we actually mentioned clean energy, sustainable agriculture, sustainable manufacturing, and real estate. Yeah, so these are the 4 sort of sectors we have chosen. And each of these sectors have their own information about what is it that they can do. And that's what you have to read. Familiarize yourself with just the information that you need, and then you basically get going by trying to develop an area. And by area, I mean a natural area that a government has given to these 4 titans of industry to kind of develop that area. And the area is essentially a natural landscape that has, I would say, a very typical European landscape, where there's forests, there's grassland, there's lakes, there's ponds, there's ocean, there's mountains and hills. So all of this stuff is this natural landscape that these 4 sectors have to kind of develop in and grow the sector, but at the same time ensure that the environmental sort of consequences of their development is also maintained, in the sense that the government says try and grow as sustainably as you can. So the idea is we need some development, but at the same time, can you do that in as sustainable way as possible? So, and this is where the gray zone comes in. How do we define sustainability, right? Does it mean not at all cutting any forest? Does it mean not at all removing any water bodies from there? Do we take into account of biodiversity? So all of these questions are there at the background that slowly emerge in the foreground as you start playing the game.
Mm-hmm. So all the time during the demonstration, and as you were presenting the setup and the operations of the game, so to speak, I've been thinking, to what extent is Pactopolis a game of chance, and to what extent is it a game of strategy?
Yeah. So I think we have a balance. It's not completely strategic, and it's not completely random. So we have gone for a mixed strategy, and this is again intentional, because the thing is, most games, of course, especially if you look in strategy games, they can be heavily strategic. And what happens if you go with very strategic games is you have to have the outcome predefined in many ways. And this is something we did not want. Also because we know that not only sustainability, but both multi-party negotiations and sustainability with sustainability thrown into the mix, can be a messy affair. And we wanted to keep that messiness of that, you know, in the game as well. And in terms of allowing people to sort of see where you go. So the chance element here starts with the, let's say, random allocation of property that you get. And by property, I mean it's just land. So how land is divvied up is a bit random. Now, we have discussed with, of course, other players who might have said, you know, more strategic game designers, and they would have argued for why not allow for more strategic allocation. And while one could do that, I think this randomness allows more negotiation to happen. And that was the reason, because at the end of the day, the focus on the game that we have always been, very clear on is that the game has to train us on negotiation skills and not strategy skills.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. So let's assume you are the real estate person and I'm the clean energy person. Yes. What is the objective of this game that we have to pursue in each of the, by the way, it's 5 rounds only.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. So at the end of each round, you know, there's some mechanism that moves it to the other. But what is the objective that we need to pursue? Is it the growth? Is it sustainability? Or how do you reconcile growth and sustainability while giving opportunities to negotiate?
Yes. So we had always looked at growth as... So, and this was one that I think we have had a lot of discussion about, and also because I have met, let's say, business school researchers from different schools and different thoughts. You also have the, let's say, the degrowth economists who have talked to us and talked about, you know, is growth always a good thing? And so, but what we have done is we have a limited growth. So it's not an unlimited growth, right? So it is still, in a way, for game purpose, I will use the term empire building. But you are limited to a certain growth number. And the reason we have kept that is because it's actually not that easy to reach that growth figure that we have set. And by that, I mean, so if you are a real estate player, you can build 2 types of buildings. You can build either a residential building or a commercial building. If you are a clean energy type of company in here, you can either build solar farms or wind farms. But the max that you can build is 7 of each. So 7 residential and 7 commercial, right? So which is actually an artificial limit now. And this artificial limit is for us to let's say, subtly also tell you that too much growth is actually going to be bad, because we have balanced the game enough that with that much of growth, you can still avoid damaging the environment, but still get decent growth figures in there. So there are 14 buildings in play, and the aim for every industry sector is, of course, to place their buildings and basically expand the empire with having 14 buildings on the map. So, but that's, I mean, it sounds easy when I say it's just 14 buildings, but for the game perspective, it's actually a very complex task, because the growth comes if you grow as a cluster and not as an independent unit. So you can't just place yourself randomly. You want to grow as a cluster where you grow sort of together. And you can either have a residential cluster or a commercial cluster. And in the case of real estate, but when you have this kind of cluster growth, and there's limitations because there's 4 other sectors, they have the same aim, agenda of having cluster growth as well. And then you have the board with the natural geographical limitations, because there's forests and lakes and mountains that you need to navigate around. So either navigate around or flatten them to build whatever you want. So those are the options you have. And that's where sort of the environment also starts playing in, including in your growth ambitions. And so this is just, let's say, the basic. And now this is just the start. This is how people will immediately see the game. What, as we have said, this is a complex game, and we add other complex mechanisms in. As you start growing, now I had told you there are 14 buildings you can build. Apart from 14 buildings, you are then provided another 9 buildings that you are allowed to build. But these 9 buildings are what we call collaborative buildings. These come later in the game, after round 2, because at that time we want you to sort of think, okay, now you've started building for yourself, but can you build for others? And this is where we actually bring in innovation. These buildings, each of these buildings, and I think this is one of the elements that took us a lot of research and a lot of time to actually figure out, because we wanted this to be real world, as real world as possible. So we did a lot of research, found all the sustainable innovations that exist, intersectoral, where one building can benefit another building or another sector. So for example, if residential has built a residence, it might want to build a car park, but a solar company could build a solar roof on top of that car park and therefore have this collaboration ongoing between energy and the residential sector. Now, this is just as an example. If I take one more example, just so that it's easier for people to understand, let's say you are building an offshore wind farm, and because you are allowed to do that. And at the same time, I won't necessarily say competing, you're competing for space, but maybe not resources, because wind energy needs wind as a resource, whereas, you know, the fishery needs fishes. But you are on the same space, so you're competing for space, essentially. But they can, of course, build the wind farms, and they can build their fishing sort of areas, which will not interact with each other. But, and this is, again, taken from real-world information, because we found out that there are zoning restrictions that are actually put where wind farms are given a particular zone and fishing zones are demarcated. And that's because, especially when I say fishing, these tend to be not just, you know, it's not just simple fishing. I'm talking about fishing industry, right? So you're basically either using deep sea trawling techniques or others that can be, of course, damaging to the environment. But especially where wind farms are concerned, they can be damaging to the cables, the energy, the underlying cables, the deep sea cables that, send the energy from the sea back to land. And that is why they keep these zones demarcated. Now, what is interesting, and again, this is something we discovered in our research, was the fish populations actually figured this out in a way. And they thought that it's actually safer for them to be in wind farm areas. So the fish populations have actually migrated more on that side. So there's lesser fish in the non. So if you actually want fish, you need to go on the windmill areas, but you can't because of zoning laws, right? But the thing is, there are technologies now that allow you to be able to actually do fishing in a safe way in wind farm areas. And at the same time, wind farms can actually build, I don't know, charging buoys or others like charging stations, so that these fish boats that will eventually become electric can actually be charged at sea and not have to go back to land to get charged. So, and these are, again, an example of collaboration that you could do. So it's, again, real-world buildings that we have taken, real-world technologies that we have put in there, and we ask you, can you actually figure out a way to use that for each other?
Mm-hmm. That sounds exciting, that places a lot of room for collaboration. Mm-hmm. And this is also my next question. If you think, I'm sure you've already tested it countless numbers of time with students in the Doris University and ESX School of Management, mm-hmm. together with Xavi. And what are the strategies that are emerging out of the complexity that you've created? Do you see any patterns, and can you link them? Can you link them to success or failure? Is there anything, is it similar to what you assumed, or did it surprise you when you saw people actually playing this game?
So I think here we need to go back to the early design. And again, game design is actually a very iterative process. And I've had to tell this many times to multiple people, because, when you see the end result, it looks like a beautiful product. It looks like a beautiful outcome, but it's not, there's been a lot of tribulations and trials getting there, right?
We are
iterating it so many times, and we have gone through multiple tests. But what we are really testing for is, of course, there's one type of test is where we're testing playability and game mechanics. That's one side of things. But the other side of things, we're also testing exactly this, what you asked for. What are the player strategies immediately? what's the player's instant reactions? What are they doing? And is there something we can do to modulate this or change this in the direction at least where we want it to go, right? So game design allows you that option to be able to do that. So when we came up with this initially, I would say, and here I'm focusing on the initial experience we had when it was just a paper and cardboard. Well, I mean, it's still a paper and cardboard product at the end. Let's just say self-cut prototype, you know, so self-made and, you know, very dirty, quick and dirty prototype, as we call it. When we tested with that, we found initial player reactions to be very, very distributive. And by distributive, I mean, so we only had one goal in the game, and that at that time, our initial version of the game. Because remember, we didn't start with sustainability. We started with negotiations as the, yes, as the aim to teach and train. And the aim was to make a lot of money. And the success criteria was that the player with the most money won the game, right? So, and because of that, it easily went to become very distributive because everybody just wanted to make more money. Sure. And no one was even looking at value creation opportunities or other things like that. So, and this was for us, we found that, okay, while it is good for, let's say, distributive simulations from that perspective, it wasn't capturing the whole gambit of negotiations that we wanted to capture. And we saw that this is something we need to change. And that's when we started slowly adding. So the first indications were we just added actually a small, you know, just a small lake or a small forest, like, or a park, that if you could grow a park together and you needed to move away from areas where you have already built, would you do that? Would people willingly? So, because, you know, we always talk in economics and in entrepreneurship as well, we talk about the tragedy of the commons, and sustainability has one of that issues as well, where it's like, you know, it's a common resource. And, you know, if it's not something that I should care about, why should I really spend a lot of energy on? And so we just started with that one. We said, okay, if you have to build a park in this area, who is going to volunteer to move out first? You know, that kind of question that was in the initial games. Mm. But that was also very hard for students. And while they did it, they were not very satisfied. And I also felt that the outcome was not, it was just, let's just do it for the sake of doing it. But it wasn't really, okay, let's do it because everybody needs a park. You know, so it was more about, it's going to be more beneficial if I do this. So, so that is why we moved away from that design. And as the game started developing, we realized that, okay, we don't only need, so distributive is good, but then players would over time start getting more integrative. And we said, okay, let's build on this integrative nature and let's start building this more. To be able to do this, we initially, I relied a lot upon people's creativity. And so we started giving blank cards to people where I said, it's a blank card. And on this blank card, you can do anything for the other person, but you have to come up with something. Use your creativity and say, I'm going to build something for you that you could do, but you use this blank card. The problem with the blank card was people actually, at that point, I don't know if it's because they froze during the time of the game or creativity requires time, which it usually does. Nobody could instantly come up with ideas. And which meant the blank cards were not really being used. And people would just use the cards as, okay, let's just throw a card. You know, I've built something for you. I'm like, and in the playtest, I would encourage the students, don't just say something, say what it is that you've tried to build for someone. You know, so they said, I've just built something. I'm like, no, put some words onto it. And they were not doing it. So after repeated testing, we realized that blank cards are actually not working, even though it would have been great in terms of room for creativity and all of that. That's when we decided, okay, we need to look for these innovations. We need to map these innovations, put them out there, and then see if people can add them and spot them where they should be added. So in that sense, it's a product of learning through iterative design that we came up with this changed mechanic. And finally, when this started working, we started seeing much more integrative negotiations coming into play. Because now, and I think this also, it's about, when you have certain visuals, these visuals started helping people because they could see what you can do rather than just imagine something abstractly in your mind and trying to convey that. So I think this was a big advantage that we noticed by giving people, it's almost like giving you a template, right? So a pre-filled template that you just have to plug in somewhere.
There's an interesting research on emergence of cooperation and in populations and different communities of even animals. It seems that you guys must have tweaked your ecosystem so that cooperation and integrative negotiating styles emerge within that ecosystem. What was that pivoting moment? What was that that change? Was it the possibility of generating additional gains by working together with others that you added in iteratively to the design of the game that mm-hmm. changed people's strategy? Or what was that shifted the attention of it's me, I have to win, I have to accumulate the resources, I have to grow, to well, maybe I can grow a little bit slower but be richer through cooperation? What was that that feature in the design?
So when designing games, we are, of course, looking at two things. We're looking at, first of all, engagement mechanics. Now, engagement mechanics are very important because a game has to be engaging, otherwise people will not spend time playing it. And competition is usually a very strong engagement mechanic. We know that. The problem, I won't say the problem, but what we noticed was with the initial competition that we have, I remember I told you it was quite distributive, right, the initial games. And this distributive would actually get quite, for some players, at least in our playtests, and these are, you know, students that we knew and who had volunteered to playtest, and some of them were friends, but they would get very argumentative on over the game, right? And I've seen this with the TNC negotiation challenges as well, where even it's just a fictional scenario and fictional cases you're working on, but people can get very emotional and very attached to that case. And we started seeing that here as well without the case. But they started, they basically got locked into positions very fast and stayed in those positions, entrenched in a way, and saw the giving up of position as a loss. And we needed, and when we changed that, that's when we realized that if we change that where they don't see it as a loss, but they see it as a gain, then we can actually start having these integrative discussions a bit more. And I would say that was really the pivot point. And at that time, we also noticed the dynamics change. The people started talking more about, okay, I can do this for you. So what is interesting is we had penalties and other things, but when we changed them to bonuses instead, that kind of, you know, that also just changes that. So and so now in the game, there's actually three resources that are at play. There is money, of course. So we still have money. Money is important. You have resources. So each of these sectors produce the resources that every other sector needs. So we created codependency through resources.
Sure.
And energy creates energy. Real estate creates human resource because people come and live in these real estate buildings. Agriculture creates food, and manufacturing creates commodities. And the idea was to build any sector, you would need all four of these commodities. But the production is limited by the amount of growth you have. So if you grow less, you will produce less, which means if you produce less, you can't help others. And this is something we had to tweak to find the right balance, of course. But this was important because I use this analogy from airplane safety videos or airplane safety demonstrations, if you've heard them, where, you know, when they talk about when the oxygen mask falls down and they say, always before you put your mask on your child, put it on yourself before you put it on your child or, you know, or your loved one. And that was the same mechanic we wanted to include here, that yes, it's good to help others. It's good to be cooperative. It's good to think about the environment, but not if you're not in a position to do so. So the idea here was growth has to be balanced in the sense that you grow a little, help, grow more, help. Because if you only start helping, so the idea being that if you're only, because we've seen some player types that could be, you know, just saying that, okay, we should not be competitive. We should, you know, you will get some of these player types, right? They would say we wants to be, let's say, overly altruistic, for example. You will actually not only inhibit yourself in the long run of the game, but you'll inhibit other players as well. So completely altruistic behavior doesn't help you. Completely competitive behavior also does not help you, because if you become too competitive, nobody wants to collaborate with you. So even though they would say, I would collaborate with someone else, because it's multiplayer, you have the option to move around to others. So that's really, I think, how we started seeing this and how it evolved. But and the more we started seeing from different players, the more we started encouraging this type of behavior through, you know, small tricks and tips that we provide to the facilitators as well. I mean, you don't really need a facilitator initially to start, but I think the facilitator is needed to really ensure that the gameplay works. But the idea is, in the negotiation rounds, there's actually no rules apply. So completely open for that one time. So which is also very interesting to design a game where you have, you know, you have five rounds and each round has eight phases or eight steps, right? And of those eight steps, one step is the negotiation round where no rules apply. The idea being it's everything can be traded, everything can be sort of, you know, discussed. You can promise, you can break promises, whatever you want to do, but only in that speak. Otherwise, you follow the guides and the rules and the processes that are inbuilt. And when we did this, we also realized that by having this kind of stepwise process, so people become familiar with the process, they know what to do, but we also started training preparation. Because suddenly, if you realize that I need now this building, or I need this resource now, but you didn't argue for it, so if you could not foresee it a little bit, then you can't just start in the middle of the game say, oh, could you please give me this, or I'll give you this. We would say, you can't do that now. You have to wait till the next negotiation round to bring what you need. And this was to try and train people in a bit of foresight and a bit of, waiting. And this is where the facilitator sort of plays a role to make sure that this happens, that, you know, you only make sure that you're only allowed to negotiate or be at the negotiating table at a specific time. And that's these rounds. In every round, there's a particular negotiation step, and we slowly increase time, which is why the game takes a little bit long. So it's right now the game plays about 3 to 4 hours, and that's mainly because each negotiation round, which is fixed, it starts with only 5 minutes in the first round, 10 minutes the second round, 15 the third, 20 the fourth, and 25 the fifth. We can probably tweak that a little bit to cut down if we needed to. But having this kind of, because we're adding more, let's say, factors, more elements, more complexity, and more things you can discuss or negotiate with this. There's more stuff always coming in, and the land is growing. There's more options available to you. Because your option space increases, we have to give you the increased amount of time as well to allow for that negotiation to happen.
Mm-hmm. As you were describing the dynamics and the mechanics of the game, I've been thinking about lessons people learn. So, the learning process is embedded into the dynamics of the game, or is it sort of the exposed learning process? Meaning, I've made my mistakes, I reflect upon them so that I know what went right or what went wrong. Or is there a chance for self-correction through observation from one round to the other? So what do you think, if we were to speak a little bit about the pedagogy of your game, yes? Mm-hmm. Is it the in-game learning process or rather exposed, experience-based learning process?
I would say it's both. It's a mix of both because there's some explicit in-game learning, and this comes from understanding resource limitations, understanding the natural area around you, and understanding the role of collaboration buildings, which are very, like I said, explicit innovations that you could actually build for others. So if you actually take the time, so every tile, and we use the word tile for game tiles because you place game tiles on a board. It's a tile placement game. Which means every tile, which is a, let's say if it's a residential building or it's a collaboration building like the solar roof that I talked about, if you turn on the back of the tile, there's text that describes what the tile is and what it does for the other. So there's some explicit learning there in terms of how you're helping someone very explicitly. But this is more in terms of innovation, more in terms of what you're doing for others, how you're helping the environment. There's some round-to-round learning as well that happens, because when you do something in round one and something happens in round two, so there's, you also, government action is always there at the end of every round. And this government action might sort of, and we took the role of government usually as the way government usually does, through penalties and rewards. And when we see that happening, we notice that players would say, okay, that's what happened last round. Maybe I need to adapt. Maybe I was building too slow. Maybe I should build faster, or I was building too fast. Maybe I should slow down. So that type of round-to-round learning does happen. Now, we have also, especially if it's integrative negotiations, we do want to train trust building, which is why we have five rounds. I mean, we could have held this game only over two rounds, right? But because we wanted trust building to happen, that is why we needed multiple rounds. Because now, because you have multiple rounds, you can start seeing, can I start building trust with one party or the other party or all the parties by promising them something? And then, because you can only promise something that you would do in the game, like hand a resource, do something for someone, cut a forest, replant a forest. There's a lot of stuff that you can promise each other. And then do you actually stay true to your promise the next round, right? That's sort of what happens. And if you are not true to your promises, then you break the trust. So that's the sort of, that's the in-game learning that you, of course, have. But there's a larger, let's say, post-game learning that you need to do as well. And the post-game learning, you need to have a reflective cycle of, okay, what just happened here? And I think the biggest reveal that we actually do is, especially if you do this, and we've done this in a classroom deployment situation test, where we had multiple tables playing, and you have multiple conditions. You have multiple players with multiple outcomes. And we are measuring three things. We are measuring resources, we are measuring money, and we are measuring negotiation points. So I think I probably forgot to talk about negotiation points, because that's the other currency in the game, which is the only non-tradable currency. So money is tradable, resources is tradable, land is tradable, but the negotiation points that you earn, and these are mentioned on the cards, and depending on how you do some of these negotiations, like if you get a certain building built, a certain collaboration building built, or if you give up a building tile for someone and someone else gives up something, then there are some very clear rules that explain how you earn some negotiation points. And these are certain points that you just tally up that you have. Made it tactile and tangible in a way that people can easily count their points. But these negotiation points is what we say, that you have to look at all of these. So at the end of the game, we will look at every table and see, what did you get in terms of negotiation points on your table? How much money did you generate per sector and for the entire, let's say, table? Plus resource per sector generated over time. And when we tabulate that and we put this into a table, what happens is you might have had four players who think they've had very good negotiations because they've been cordial to each other, they've been helping each other out a lot, and they think they've had a good outcome. When they listen then to the scores of another table that probably has 1.5x score higher than theirs in terms of both money, resource, which meant they have actually been able to identify value and add value more than you have. And that completely surprises them, which then tells them, okay, now you need to reflect, what is it that you could have done better because there was value that you left out of the table? Yes, you did a good deal and you made a good, everyone is happy of the outcome, but it's only when you hear your neighboring teams or others that you might suddenly get an idea, because it's relative here, how well or bad you did in terms of the possible outcome you could generate.
Mm-hmm. So the pedagogy is there. And who wins this game?
That's a good question. So we have had that very tough struggle because we wanted, you have a game, of course, you need to have a winner. But the idea here was we wanted to keep it multifaceted. So in the end, of course, we are looking, simply there is one very clear rule, of course, which is, you win if you have the most negotiation points, the most money, and the most resources at the end of the game, right? Most negotiation points is rewarding you for actually having done a lot of good integrative negotiations, not just, rolling over others, for example. Most money also means you've been able to balance your economics very well and maybe slightly better on the distributive side as well. Most resources basically also means that you have been able to make sure that you have enough for yourself and enough to supply the other sectors. But this is actually technically very hard to reach. It's kind of one of those things where it's really hard to reach. And what you will normally see what happens is you might have one table with someone with a lot more money than anybody else, and then someone with a lot more negotiation points and someone with a lot more resources. The clear winner would, of course, be one with all. But when that happens, then there's titles that has been divvied out where we say you were the most, you were an eco warrior if, for example, you did a lot of things for the environment, but you lost out on the economic part. Or you are an economic giant because you really played well with money, but you lost out on the negotiation points. So you get these different titles and the government just rewards you these titles, which sort of basically rewards you for the strengths of what you did, but at the same time pointing out your weaknesses.
Okay. And what's your observation in terms of the players finding balance between winning and doing something for their ecosystems, which means sustainability?
Mm-hmm. So the sustainability element grows and becomes even more, let's say, relevant as you play along. So what happens is you start by just growing your sector. So initially, you know, it's like I'm just placing my residential buildings or my solar farms, wherever, and I'm not really bothered about the environment initially, right? So, but as you start growing, the environment starts putting restrictions because you're running out of space, easy space that you can grow in. By easy space, I mean flat land or grassland in this case. And suddenly you now have to think about, okay, do I need to start removing forests? And actually forest removal, for example, which is in the game, it's possible to do so. It's also possible to reclaim land from water bodies. All of that comes at a pretty significant cost. And these costs are actually mirrored after real values. For example, we found out from a Belgium forest professor that usually the cost of cutting a forest and replanting a forest, the government usually puts a rate of around 2.8x the amount that it costs. And we have more or less similar figures in terms of the numbers. And again, this was retrospective finding. When we designed it was something we felt intuitive to the game, but we found out that in real world policy, this actually exists with similar numbers. That was a nice finding, which again, probably speaks about the power of good game design because there's probably some game mechanics also in policy making. But when you are having this type of situation, I've got a good balance now between getting high scores, and I figured out how to get high scores, let's say, from high negotiation points. But if the other player has not figured that out, the idea would be that they have to play again, right? So it's only when they play again, that's when they can probably iterate their strategies a bit better. And when they do that, they will also start seeing the sustainability value even more, because we are bringing in sustainability not only through the terrain, that's one element, we're also bringing it through, there are some elements that we have where there's bonuses that are either through the carbon credit system that we have introduced. Again, this is layered and comes in later, but you could get carbon credit bonuses, you could get government regulations, bonuses for biodiversity, for example. So we have one very simple one where if an agricultural person plants crop farms next to meadows, but owns meadows and does not develop meadows, that actually increases biodiversity and you get rewarded by the government from it for doing so. And in terms of a monetary gain, because and you get a biodiversity plus. So by doing this, you are actually also learning that, oh, this is what I could do to actually increase sustainability. So, and here we're also teaching you that sometimes you need to own land and not do anything on it. That's as good as, you know, saying that, okay, I'm not going to cut a forest. Sometimes you need to own the forest and make the intentional action of not cutting it. Mm-hmm. So these are things that you would learn, and that's how the sustainability narrative emerges in the game. But I think you need a post-game debrief to also bring this into light even more with real world examples and real, like, all of this stuff that I've just told you, like, for example, the forest, you know, cutting and replanting rates, and this kind of biodiversity narrative. It's just mentioned as one line in the game, which players may miss immediately or not sort of capture fully the value, but a post-game debrief would bring home the point, and they'd probably never forget it because they've experienced it.
So, Rajiv, if you think about the debriefs, what do you observe among your students? Do they become better negotiators, or do they become more aware to sustainability, or both?
I would say both. I think it's probably a very loaded question there. Right? So, because, and again, why I say both is very specific. So, when you have students coming in, so like, this is a long game, like I said, and it's a game that can also draw in emotions. So I've had players that become very, because you start distributive, and in the initial distributive rounds, players can get very positional and very entrenched, but that changes very fast when they start seeing other outcomes and other ways to do things. And they suddenly start figuring out, oh, this is how we can do this. This is how we can grow. And at the same time, so this is how we can grow ourselves and grow others and grow the environment, or, you know, or protect the environment. So when they start seeing all of this happen, there's this kind of, it's almost like a emergence of knowledge or something, like you've just learned something new that excites you. And I think that's what we see, which probably explains the high engagement level. And I'm not joking. Because I've had professors, because I tested this game not only at Aarhus, and I say I also tested it at Indian Institute of Management in Shillong recently, where I was for a short sabbatical. And when I tested that, it was the same. The initial reaction from the professors was, there's no way a four-hour game players would sit engaged. But they do. They sit 3-4 hours, and they're not ready to leave the table. I have a very short anecdote where I can give an example. We had, in a playtest at Aarhus, I had eight players, two teams. Xavi was there with us at that time as well. We had a fire alarm that disrupted play after 2.5 hours. So we had to evacuate the building, you know, and as the fire drill, I don't know if it was a drill, but it was a fire alarm. We had to leave, and we had to leave the table as it is. And we had already played 2.5 hours or 2 hours, 45 minutes. I had booked the students for about 3 hours. And this fire drill, by the time it, you know, everything was okay and we could move back into the building, that took 45 minutes. It was already 3.5 hours. I told the students, that's long, you know, it's more than what you had committed to. So you guys can go home. We'll find another day. We didn't really know that we would be disrupted by this fire drill. None of them, and literally none of them from the 8 players that were there, wanted to go back. They all wanted to sit. No, we want to complete the game. It was late. It was, you know, we started in the evening. It was late towards dinner time. And, you know, they were like, nope, we need to see how this game ends. And I need to see whether I'm doing well or not, or good or not. So this engagement factor for me was, when I saw that, I'm like, okay, this is working. Because they had the excuse to go, right? But they didn't.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Rajiv, is there, I have two more questions. Mm-hmm. We're slowly coming to an end, but two more we will do. Is there anything else that you would like us to know about Paktopolis?
I think I've talked quite a bit, but I think there was something that I really want to highlight, which came out for us in the test. And this is, I think we have found a balance, but finding this balance was not easy. Because when I say balance, because remember, I'm at a natural faculty, natural sciences faculty. Xavi is at a business school, at a management school. And therefore, our types of students that we interact are very different. So the type of playtesters we get are also very different. And I, of course, want to ensure that my students, and when I say my students, I'm referring to the natural science students, that they are also engaged. Xavi probably wants her business students also to be engaged. And when we brought them into, I think, when we brought them together, we've had some situations where we've had both as well, you know, but usually the tests have been either only business students or only natural science students, or the environmental students. when we had the natural science students play, and especially when I say natural science, I would now specifically refer to when I got students, especially from the Department of Biology or the Department of Environmental Sciences. They thought there was too less sustainability in the game, right? So, and then I had like people like soil scientists and others who basically looked at the game and they said, this is great, but you haven't taken into account soil quality. You haven't taken into account like so many things that you could do, right? So, and when we went to the business school with it, the initial reaction, especially in students, was this is too complex. We can't wrap our heads around this. There's too much. There's too much happening, especially in the sustainability space. And we realized that if it's too much of sustainability as well, and again, you might laugh or people might say there can't be too much of sustainability. I mean, but you know, sustainability is a complex topic. I mean, you know, people spend entire disciplines towards it, right? And there's a lot more that we haven't covered in the game, and we can't, both because of time, complexity, many other reasons. But we also understood that if it's so complicated, or if it's too overbearing or overwhelming for, let's say, the management students. And again, this is no disrespect to the management students, because they are coming from a completely different space. They know other things they're good at. But if they are not, if they leave the table because they think it is not worth their time or whatever, then we have lost the plot ourselves, because then we have failed to engage them as well. So we needed to find that sweet spot where they can be engaged, and the sciences who or environmental sciences can also be engaged. And I think we have found that balance. Even though we can easily create different versions of the game, because the game is actually very modular. It allows us to tweak it, and we can tweak it to add more complexity or less complexity as needed. And right now in the game design, we have two mats, so two sides. On one side of the mat, we actually have, let's say, hills as a landscape feature, and we have marshes and meadows. And on the other, we remove that and say, okay, we just play with forests and water bodies, and that's it. So, you know, so we have kind of tweaked that. And in a way, you could play the first one and then increase. And as we add more, we could add more of this, like, you know, soil and other sectors that I think we could easily do.
That's an amazing project. That's an amazing product. I promised that my next question would be the last, but let me squeeze one in between. When is this game, when is Pactopolis going to hit the market?
Yeah, so I think we are very, very close to the market release. In fact, Taru just sent me information today that our boxes have arrived, but they are our initial boxes. So I'm actually both me and Taru, we are going to ISEC next week. So next Monday on the 16th with Chavi students from the management school, we're going to do this live deployment test again with the final version of the game as we see it, and to see if we still need tweaks or not. And if we don't need any more tweaking at that point, then I would say by the next month, we would be happy to announce it as a formal release. If we still need some tweaking, maybe another couple of months before it's out.
So fingers crossed, Rajiv, to you and the team. We'll be looking out for Pactopolis. We'll be looking out for the game. I think you've raised our appetite to test it out, and not only in the classroom environment, but also I can imagine playing it for fun instead of Settlers of Catan.
Yes.
Right? Because that one is pretty much economics or business oriented. Whereas Pactopolis adds another layer to it, the sustainability layer to it. My last question is always the same. That's about greatness.
One thing, Remy, I just wanted to quickly say is that we have had students who've walked up to me after playing the game and say, when can I buy the game? And that's basically also a good sign that they're interested from an entertainment value, not just learning value. Even though I think the debrief and all of that provides all the learning as well. So I think it works on both sides. So I just wanted to pick that.
And that's exactly the best situation when one comes with the other. What's the best way of learning other than by having fun while doing it, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
Perfect. So my last question is always the same. It's always about greatness in negotiation. So Rajiv, when you think about great negotiators, historical or contemporary, who comes to your mind?
That's always a tough one because I think it's not an easy, let's say, question to answer immediately at the top of my head. But I would say, I mean, one that undoubtedly leaves an imprint, and maybe not everyone might agree with it, but I still think it's, for me at least, it would be Mahatma Gandhi. And I think he comes as a strong negotiator mainly because it was principles-based negotiations. And with a very non-aggressive sort of ideology behind, with the non-violence movement that he sort of started, and sort of really showing that, yes, we can, like, inaction is also a way of action. And for me, that was a very powerful message. But other than that, I think he was a lawyer by profession, by the way. He started as a lawyer. So he, of course, had all the legal skills and traits to make points and argue points, I think. But I also liked his approach to, for example, sustainability, when he started seeing with this whole idea of make yourself, build yourself, you know, clothes, so that you're not under oppression of the oppressor who basically controls the resources. Then he says, okay, then let's look local and find only local stuff to produce our own clothes and stuff. So in that sense, he was also an environmentalist in that way. So Mahatma Gandhi definitely comes to mind as, of course, maybe a political negotiator. As an environmental negotiator, I would say I also think of the people behind the Cradle to Cradle book, William McDonough and Michael Braungart, who were a strong influence to me during my MBA years. And my MBA thesis looked at the Cradle to Cradle hypothesis. And I think when I've met them and seen them speak, while I haven't seen them actively negotiating their positions, but for someone to have so strong sustainability-driven agendas and to actually, and having succeeded in incorporating industry to try and strive for their rather hard to get sustainability labels, the C2C certification labels, which I think is a testament to their also negotiation skills in some way, is what I would say.
Thank you, Rajiv, so much for sharing the insights on Pactopolis and greatness in negotiation. Guys, if you listen to us, be on the lookout for Pactopolis, a sustainability negotiation game or a negotiation sustainability game, whichever way you phrase it, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be engaging and it's going to hit the market soon. Rajiv, thank you so much. It was great having you on the show, and until the last time on the podcast on negotiation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.